Slate Money is sponsored by Trunk Club. Answer a few simple questions about your look, style, and size, and receive a trunk full of great-looking clothes that fit perfectly and make you look amazing. Only pay for the clothes you keep with no ongoing subscription, and shipping is free. Go to trunkclub.com/money.
Hello, and welcome to a very, very special 4th of July wine edition of Slate Money, which is normally your guide to the business and finance news of the week, but this week is just about my favorite subject, which is wine, and specifically about rosé wine. I am sitting here in the Slate studios on the 4th of July with the one and only Kathy O'Neill, the blogger at mathbabe.org.
Glad to be here, Felix.
And with Jordan Weissman, the Moneybox columnist for Slate.
Glad to see you, Felix.
And before Jordan starts making snarky comments, I have to introduce the one and only Carl Storchman, who is the managing editor of the greatest journal in the world, which is the Journal of the American Association of Wine Economists. And if you aren't on Carl's AAWE email list, I can assure you, you are missing out, because this is awesome stuff. And I'm super, super happy that Carl is here with us.
Thank you very much, Felix.
And also you're a genuine economics professor at NYU as well. So
There's that.
It's not just about wine. So this is the wine edition. I decided on the spur of the moment last week that after we talked about beer for a little bit, which is, as Carl will agree, not remotely as interesting subject.
It's kind of inferior, right?
Inferior, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, wow. We're already getting into this.
We are going to talk about wine. And this being summertime, we are especially going to talk about the only drink that you should drink in the summer, which is rosé wine, which is the best drink. And I have in front of me 4 bottles of rosé wine, and we're going to be tasting, by which I mean drinking, these bottles over the course of our discussion. And so if we start slurring our speech or anything like that towards the end, then you can know it's the rosé talking.
Yeah, my number is definitely going to be how many we polish off, I think. That's...
So, one of the things, there have been a few questions because it gets complicated. We don't normally drink large quantities of wine while recording this. And I felt that rather than just make these decisions before the podcast, I was going to do a little bit of explaining of what we're doing and what we're not doing. And I will sort of sprinkle these things around the podcast. But the first thing I'm going to just tell you guys who are listening is that we have 1 wine glass in front of us, each of us.
Confusing.
Which, according to Kathy, is confusing because she reckons that if we're drinking 4 different wines, then we should have 4 different
wine
glasses.
Should we just pour them all in and then slosh them around?
That was what I was expecting. We're going to make kind of a cocktail here, right?
How do we take?
It's a blend.
How do we make sure the cups are clean between tastings? That's
okay. So that's the first little wine lesson, is that you don't need to stress that stuff. If you have multiple wines, you do not need to have a new glass for a new wine. That's it's a sort of swanky service thing in swanky restaurants to make you feel special. But the fact is, if you just finish 1 glass of wine and then pour a new bottle of wine into the same old glass, the amount of old wine in that glass is going to be so small. And in fact, you're basically just diluting wine with wine. All wine tastes of wine. You're not going to taste it. It's not going to make a difference to the taste. Just go ahead.
I have another question. Before I'm gonna let you go on, because I've had chocolate tastings where it depends on which chocolate you taste first. So how about the order? If you're convinced that it's not like it doesn't matter.
So that's another really good question. And in general, as Carl will agree, in general the order goes from the lightest to the heaviest.
Mm. How do you know though?
Helpfully with rosé.
Yes.
When I say lightest to heaviest, I'm literally talking about the color.
Oh.
And so we have 4 bottles of wine in front of us here. One of them is the very expensive Domaine Haute. One of them next to it is Domaine Pré-Baron from the Loire. The Domaine Haute is from Provence. We then have I don't know what Jordan came up with. He brought something called a Merlot Petit Verdot Cuvée Rosé from South Africa by a maker called Eikendal or something. Have you ever heard of Eikendal?
No.
Jordan, do you know anything about Eikendal?
No, but I have fondness for Stellenbosch, so I have nostalgia for
that. This is from Stellenbosch. And finally, in terms of the darkest wine, we have something called Alone, because that's the saddest name for a wine that I've
I'm a goth, what can I say?
Ever found. It's called Alone. We're going to be drinking it with friends, and it is a Monastrell from Spain, somewhere. I don't know, even know. Alicante? I don't know. So anyway, we are going to just be helping ourselves to wine. And if you want to do it in the classic order, you might want to do it from lightest to darkest. If you want to do it some other way, you can do it some other
way. What's the reasoning, though, for lightest to darkest? What's the reasoning there? The sweetness or something?
I don't know. I guess it's like the flavor or maybe even the potential alcohol.
So with a rosé, they've macerated some of the like skins in there. So wouldn't you get more tannins in the darker ones, or like wouldn't
and,
they
in
be?
In general, yeah. Yeah. And in general, what happens is the darker wines and heavier wines they're heavier. They're a little bit sweeter. They're a little bit more tannic, or they're oakier. And the more of that you have, the less able you start being to distinguish the more subtle stuff in the lighter wines. So it kind of overpowers the lighter wine.
I'm going to say something really, really obnoxious, but it's sort of like how with like sushi, you get an omakase meal and they'll give you like the light fish to start it off with.
Yeah, that's...
And then it'll go to like the fatty tuna at the
that's
end.
That's not offensive.
I thought that was a little pompous. But anyway, so you go from the light like white fish to the fatty tuna.
I'm just going
to
think of it as bloodiness.
So that's also.
And I will also talk a little bit later on about why we are not even attempting to do a blind tasting here. This is one of my favorite subjects, but we will come to that in a minute.
So, Felix, you're going to start pouring?
Yes, I'm going to start pouring. I'm going to start pouring for me. I'm not going to pour it for anyone else, because the way this is going to work is that everyone will just simply... We're clicking all of the
microphones. Lots of extra noises.
Lots of extra noises. The way this is going to work is we are just going to be drinking these four wines over the course of the... of the podcast.
Okay, here we go. This is a brave experiment.
I think
podcasting.
I will not follow this rule. I will just pour this one. Maybe we should drink from dry to sweet.
And I doubt any of them are sweet. But the yeah, we are just going to drink the four wines over the course of the podcast, and we are going to at the end of the podcast have a little discussion about what we thought of them all and how much they cost, because that is. And when we asked you to send in your questions, and thank you for everyone who sent in their questions, that is the number one question which everyone wants to know, everyone wants to talk about, is what I call the price quality question. So, Jordan.
So, yeah, we got an email from Harold Pollack. We were really excited about this. He's a very well-known health policy professor at University of Chicago. I love his work, and apparently he likes ours, which is awesome. But so he writes... isn't 98% of the wine economy fundamentally based on the uninformed, possibly self-deluded snob appeal of most wine consumers? Put another way, what percentage of these consumers can reliably distinguish a $100 bottle of wine from, say, a $20 bottle? And what percentage would genuinely prefer the more expensive bottle?
Okay, so, and Carl, we actually had, and this is... By sheer coincidence, no one knew you were coming on this show, but we actually had an email come in from Van Brenner about your very paper, right?
You're right. So Van wrote about, so he just cites a paper that we published in 2008 in our Journal of Wine Economics. And that is about, do people prefer in a blind tasting cheaper wines over expensive wines? And so this was a tasting of about 5,000 wines. And I think the mean result was at least non-experts preferred cheaper wine over expensive wines. And experts, there is no clear link between price and quality perception.
And I can tell you that I've had a wine party at my house every year for many, many years now. And we do this thing where everyone brings a bottle of wine and you taste it blind and you give it a ranking, and then you add up the rankings, and then you do a little scatter plot between the ranking, the price, and the perceived ranking. I might talk a bit more.
What kind of parties do you throw? Scatter plot parties?
We throw scatter plot parties. And yeah, I mean, every so often you can get a small, statistically significant negative correlation between price and quality. That often that happened in the Pinot Noir tasting, for instance. Sometimes there's a tiny positive correlation, but the overarching lesson you get is there's basically no correlation at all.
Right, right.
But, so we're going to answer this question. Can you tell a $100 wine from a $10 wine? Is there an increase in quality as you go up in price? And I'm going to answer and say, yes, you can. It's incredibly easy, and the increase is incredibly noticeable. Carl's study notwithstanding.
I would not agree. So we have done with our group a couple of really intriguing things. So there was in 1976 in Paris this blind tasting, which is now known as the Judgment of Paris.
Famous, the legendary Judgment of Paris.
And there's a book on this by George Tabor. So with George Tabor, we did exactly the same thing at our meeting in Princeton.
You did the Judgment of Princeton.
Right, now it's called the Judgment of Princeton. And so the Judgment of Paris was 1976. That was wines from France, all like the top wines. It was Chateau Moutot Rothschild, Aubryon, Montrose, Leo Villascars, like really, really expensive wines. They were pitched against wines from a region that no one knew back then, and that was Napa. And it was in Paris, French wine judges, all like the most like prestigious French wine experts, drinking blind. And the scandal of the whole thing was it was a wine from Napa that won. And so that was a big thing. Here, it's like a bigger thing than it is in France. So we did the same thing here in Princeton. And we pitched, we bought the same wines. We bought Mouton Rothschild, Aubryon, which now they cost a fortune. So we paid like $1,200 for the Mouton, $1,200 for the Aubryon. You have to buy two. You have to buy a third one because one could be corked. So this, you can tell, we spent like thousands of dollars on this. And we pitched them not against the wines from Napa, but against the wines from New Jersey. And that was a shocking thing.
Yes, the wines from New Jersey. You heard that right.
It's the Garden State.
These wines are awesome. There are some really awesome wines. Before the tasting, they all cost like $15. Now we like ran the whole tasting with famous wine bloggers, wine writers. So I don't want to like tell who it was. They might feel embarrassed. But it was very difficult to tell like apart a $15 wine from New Jersey from a $1,200 wine from Bordeaux. And if you run the stats, it was all a tie.
I can definitely agree, Carl. Carl actually brought in a bottle of one of these fabulous New Jersey wines, which are incredibly hard to find. He's right about that. And especially hard to find outside New Jersey. They're basically impossible to find outside New Jersey. And it was fantastic.
Well, I've been quiet till now because I know nothing about wines. But I do want to talk about my personal ranking system on ranking systems. I have this like what I call a snob ranking system, and I think it's about time to talk about this because I think a lot of this stuff has to do with perceived snobbery. My snob level one is you can't tell; you just like everything. Okay, the snob level two is you can tell the difference, but you don't care. You're just like, oh yeah, I like good coffee or I like good rosé, but I don't really care. Snob level three is when you can tell the difference and you do care. You're like, I really don't want to drink the bad stuff. And then snob level four is when you can may or may not be able to tell the difference, but you look down on people who don't care. And I feel like there's like levels three and four get very confused in all these discussions.
And snob level, I don't know what's orthogonal to one to ABC. I like 1, 2, 3, 4. Snob level A,
yeah,
is people like my friend Charles Kenny who say that everyone who claims to be able to tell the difference is wrong, and they use studies like Carl's and the kind of thing that Harold is talking about, and they look down on anyone who claims to be able to tell the difference between good wine and bad wine, or even that there is a difference between
right.
Good
well,
wine
and I would just defend that because, like, even if it's not true, even if there are people who can tell the difference, feel sorry for them, like, right? Because wouldn't it be ideal to be in level one at all times for all things? You just enjoy everything. You can't tell the difference, and you don't care.
Ignorance is bliss,
and you can spend less money on this stuff.
It's certainly cheaper to be in snob level one. I don't know if it's better because there is an enormous amount of pleasure. And this is going to bring me to my big thesis, which is basically that, yes, everything that Carl said is true about blind tastings. In a blind tasting, it is very difficult to tell expensive wine from cheap wine for various reasons. And if you hear the glug?
The glug and, distracted Felix. Pass that bottle
but,
over here.
But that notwithstanding, it's not only very easy to tell the difference between expensive wine and cheap wines, but people do it every day, and that people get a lot of pleasure out of expensive wines, and they get significantly more pleasure out of expensive wines than they get out of cheap wines. And the reason for all this is, drum roll, that no one drinks wine in blind tastings except for in incredibly artificial environments, which are set up in, you know, by wine economists in Princeton and stuff like that, that everything you know from a blind tasting is wrong.
It's context. Yeah. You're saying that they enjoy the context itself.
That goes for a lot. Yeah. Pretty much any tasting.
It goes for the Pepsi challenge. Yeah. The fact is, people prefer Coke to Pepsi. But in a blind tasting, people prefer Pepsi to Coke.
Oh, there's one thing that I would like to add to that.
Go on.
In my classes here, I do these tests. You have three cups. So I do them with my students because I cannot let them drink wine. Which that would have been the first best choice, but I cannot do that.
Because they're under 21, is that it?
Yeah, and I don't know what the school policy is. But in France, I let them drink wine, so I teach that too. But so here I have three cups with two drinks, Coke and Pepsi. So two of the three drinks are the same and one is odd. So one is not the same. They're called ABC. It could be AB is Coke, C is Pepsi, or B is Pepsi, and so stuff like that. So the task for them is to tell me which one is the odd one. And the random chance is a third. But before they do that, they have to tell me what is their preference. And it's exactly like what you said. Everybody prefers Coke. Except for at Rutgers, they prefer Pepsi. Because on campus, they only can drink Pepsi. That's why. But normally, everybody prefers Coke. But when they have these three cups, and they have this, oh, are these drinks the same? So they smell, go back and forth. It's random. They don't even know if these drinks are the same. We do that also for wine. So you don't even know the two glasses that you have, are they the same or not?
So yeah,
and it's totally like a crapshoot.
When you're drinking wine blind, it's a crapshoot.
So Phil, because you're making a good point though. The broader issue is that we're incredibly susceptible to any kind of suggestion when it comes to what we're experiencing taste-wise.
That's the power of marketing.
It goes for wine, it goes for soda, it goes for cigarette smokers.
Cars.
They can't tell the difference between their favorite brands, essentially, or they can't tell what their favorite cigarette is in blind smoke test, I suppose you'd call it. But with wine, they have examples where there's another famous test where it's not just they can't, you know, tell the difference in a blind tasting. It's if you give people white wine and red wine, or if you give people white wine, right? Just all white wine, the same white wine in two different glasses, but dye one of them red, they'll then the red one as red wine. And you see real world versions of this occasion. I was reading an article the other day about orange wine, and all of the descriptors they were using for it were things like, it tastes like orange peel and apricot. And there's no reason why orange wine should taste, because the way they make it should taste like an orange. That's fantastic.
But at the same time, number one, orange wine is, like, that's the one you can always pick out in a blind test because it just tastes weird. But number two is...
it's not actually blind. That's the thing.
Although, actually, if you do it blind, and this is the other thing that Jordan was referring to, they've gone one step further from the blind taste test and actually started serving room temperature wine in black glasses.
Yep.
And then, and if you do that, you can't even tell the difference between red and white.
Wow.
But this is all completely artificial and completely stupid. And the fact is that wine is about storytelling as much as anything else. Wine is about the person who makes it, the place that it comes from, the story of the wine, the story of where you got it, how you discovered it, who introduced you to it, who introduced you to the winemaker, what you know about the region, that time you went on holiday, that time you had that great meal in that great restaurant, that time your best friend, blah, 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 blah. Wine has a whole set of broad and rich associations in our mind, and the more we drink it, the more associations we have with it. And what you do when you taste wine blind is you artificially eradicate all of those associations, and it's those associations which to a large degree give us the pleasure. And one of my theories is that one of the reasons that expensive wine is so expensive is that Well, I call it the most efficient and predictable way of turning money into happiness that the world has ever discovered. They say that money can't buy happiness, but actually it can. If you go into a wine store and spend more money than you would normally spend on a bottle of wine, and there's like a decent person who's helping you pick out that bottle of wine, you will like that bottle more just by dint of the fact that it's expensive. And if you're rich and you spend thousands of dollars on a bottle of wine, the same thing happens. And you've associate it with stories, and it's incredibly predictable.
Aren't you just arguing that marketing brings us pleasure? Like, that's it? Like, we are, like, marketing's just awesome?
Carl, is this marketing, or is this actually something deeper and more human than that?
So I think there's two things that I would like to add to that. Yeah, it is a story, but it also can be bad, right? You drank this wine on your vacation in the south of France, and it was awesome. You buy a case and schlep it here, and it's terrible. Right. So you cannot transport the story. So the wine is not really hinged to the story. You think it is, but it loses the story. And then it becomes just, oh, man, how terrible is this wine? Why was I so crazy to bring this wine and smuggle it through the customs? But your story is, I think that's fascinating, to buy happiness. There was a paper in PNAS, that's the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, in 2008. And what they did there is they wired people's brain. So there is like the frontal cortex in your brain that lights up when you perceive pleasure. So they looked at, do people really perceive pleasure? So they poured the same wines, but they told him, oh, this is a wine that costs $5. This is a wine that costs $20. This is a wine that costs $60. And this is a wine that costs $115. And the brain really lit up like crazy when they thought they are drinking this $115 wine. So it is real. It is real pleasure, real happiness that comes with that. And let me add one more thing. It's probably the same with cars, right? Because if a car were a thing that takes you from A to B, you can buy a smart car. That will be cheap. But you can buy a big Beamer. It costs $150,000. And it's more pleasure. It probably is faster and all of these things, but also has that price tag to it. And so back to the snob thing. Yeah, there is a huge snob component.
Well, I also want to say that it depends on your upbringing. Like, my father loves wine, and he is somebody who was like born in, you know, he was poor when he was a kid. So now he has money. He loves buying that wine. You know, my husband is Dutch, and Dutch people do not like spending extra money.
They're not wine drinkers. They're beer drinkers.
But I'm just saying, there's no part of his fabric that says, I'm going to get more pleasure out of spending twice as much as I need to on a bottle of wine. I do think there's a like social aspect to it. It depends on who you are.
I'm going to pick up on that in a minute, because we got another fantastic letter from Sarah Leach. But before we talk about Sarah Leach, I'm going to talk about another way you can spend money and buy happiness, which is our sponsor. It's actually a really cool sponsor, I have to say. I'm into this one. It's called Trunk Club, and it is a great way of spending money and buying happiness, because if you're a guy...
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
If you're a guy, I can tell, as a guy, I can say this. There's one place where spending money is just buying misery, and that's when you're going out and trying to buy clothes. American men and men in general hate just spending time and effort schlepping around trying to find something which fits and looks good. And this is why most American men look dreadful and have no fashion sense. It's because they just pick the first thing they find on the rack, off the rack, and run away because they can't even with the shopping and the deciding and all of this kind of stuff. I am here with manna from heaven for all of you guys. It's called Trunk Club, and you don't need to do anything. You just sign up at trunkclub.com/money, and they will send you your clothes. It's as simple as that. And then they'll send you a trunk of clothes, and you can just try them on at home, and you can send them all back if you don't like them. And if you do like them, you just keep them, and then you pay for them, and that's easy. And if you're in New York, I actually did this in New York. And in New York and a few other major cities, they have, like, in New York, it's this mansion next to the Palace Hotel. They've, like, bought out this entire mansion. And you go in there, and they serve you a drink, and they'll come up with clothes, and they'll do anything for you. It's not just off-the-peg stuff. They will make you suits. They will make you shirts. They will do anything for you. They will you know, they would look after you. They don't ask you to choose anything. They just say, here's, try this on, try this on. This is cool. And then whatever you like, they'll hem it for you. They'll tailor it for you. They'll send it to you in a trunk. It's painless. It's actually pleasurable. So this is, you get to look good. And you don't get to hate your life because you're going shopping and you hate going shopping. So everything is free at Trunk Club. The stylist, the shipping, the shopping, the trunk. Everything is free. Trunkclub.com/money. This is not a subscription thing. No one is going to charge you like X dollars a month or anything like that. You only pay if you find a piece of clothing just like kind of drops in your lap and you love it. It's great. Anyway, so trunkclub.com/money. Kathy.
Yes. Sarah Leach wrote to us, and she said the following. I thought it was appropriate to share a family tradition with you, as long as you have wine in mind as a possible topic. My family has always been big on wine, and since we all live in the Bay Area right now, we tend to meet up to go wine tasting in Napa and Sonoma a few times a year. We go to our favorite, largely very expensive wineries, and gush over the wine we could never afford. One of the things we do, to keep things in perspective, is something we've nicknamed the Charles Shaw Index. When we taste wine, we'll think about how many bottles of less expensive wine we could buy for the same cost. We gave it the nickname because Charles Shaw is always our baseline measurement, but we often also include slightly more expensive wines as well. No matter how wonderful a wine is, it's basically never worth the opportunity cost. It really emphasizes how dramatic the diminished returns are with expensive wine by reminding yourself that normally the $100 bottle of wine isn't going to give you double the enjoyment of a $50 bottle of wine. And certainly not 20 times the enjoyment of a decent $5 bottle of wine.
Okay, so this is the thing where we just spent a bunch of time talking about the relationship between price and quality. And now this is a very interesting twist on this, which is the relationship between quantity and pleasure or utility or whatever. Do you get twice as much pleasure out of two bottles of wine as you do out of one bottle of wine?
Are you in college? That's the question. Because I will tell you, in college, I certainly did.
Carl?
You can like stretch the whole thing. You don't have to drink it all at one sitting. So yeah, you can drink one on Monday and one on Tuesday and one on Wednesday. And that's pleasure. So that's a fantastic thing. There's this California Wine Fair. So the California Wine Fair gives gold medals and silver medals and bronze medals and so forth to wine. And so if you make wine, you can submit your wine. You have to pay, of course, a fee. And then there are judges that taste it. And it's a fantastic thing. So they have flights of 25 wines and then like four or five wine experts, judges. So they're all pros. And they go up and down, up and down, and they taste and they add and they give gold or silver or bronze or like nothing or flawed. It's kind of five ranks. And the Charles Shaw, which is also known as the Two-Buck Chuck, got once a double gold. It was deemed the best wine of the state of California. This was a blind tasting.
It was a Chardonnay, right?
Yeah, I think it was Chardonnay. I'm not really sure if that was. But it was a big thing, and it got the next year the same thing. So at a blind tasting, and that leads us, goes back straight to like the first question by Van Branner. There is maybe an inverse relation between perceived quality and
okay, so I'm going to jump in here and talk about blind tasting very quickly because it's one of my pet peeves. One of the reasons why the upstart New World California Cabernets did so well in the Judgment of Paris is because they were bigger and heavier and sweeter and more tannic and more alcoholic.
And more oaky, probably.
And oakier and all of those things. And when you taste wines side by side, the heavier, sweeter wines always win. And what Charles Shaw has done is he makes heavy, sweet wines. When I say he, I mean whatever huge multinational corporation it is that makes Charles Shaw.
I think Fred Francia, the guy behind Bronco Wines, which makes is an American hero.
In any case, you know, it is no surprise to me that a bunch of young, because all of these wines were quite young as well when they were being tasted, and they were comparing young Napa wines with young Bordeaux, and Bordeaux is not designed to be drunk young, and at the time in the 70s, all California wine was drunk young. And so that was like an artificial hand on the scale in favor of California as well. But in general, one of the reasons that I don't trust blind tasting on anything is precisely because in blind tastings, people tend to prefer sweeter stuff, even when in real life they don't.
So how However, I'm kind of glad that that happened, that Charles Shaw won that gold medal. And here's why. What we've just been talking about how the perception of value and the story associated with expensive wine adds pleasure to it. What $2 chuck, or it's now $3 or $4 chuck, did was it kind of made cheap wine okay for, you know, yuppies, for urbanites, you know, where it previously had been associated with at best, like, you know, you were getting a jug of Carlo Rossi. Now you could go and get $3 chuck and say, oh, this is good wine. And so it, you know, again, the power of marketing, it made it possible for people to go to the grocery store and be happy and content with this $2.99 bottle that they then didn't have to go and splurge and spend an extra $17 to get the same pleasure at dinner.
But okay, so this is talking about pleasure at dinner. I just had a fantastic wine dinner with a bunch of dudes, because of course it's always dudes, isn't it? I mean, I wish there were more women, you know. Anyway, I have to say there are two big things which I love about wine right now, which I'm really into. One is the Loire Valley, and my rosé today is from the Loire Valley. And the other one is women winemakers, who are just the most exciting. I always buy wine by women winemakers when I can. But anyway, to not get off the subject.
I was gonna say, Felix is getting excited.
Felix, usually you're yelling at me for kind of going off the reservation. This episode, you're just peripatetic. You're just
Where was I?
It's the wine.
I don't know.
Something about female winemakers in California and a table of dudes.
The table of dudes. Yeah. So we're talking about this whole quality, or rather quantity question, which is, you know, are you better off with $100 wine or $5 $20 wines? And I was at this table of dudes, and there was a bunch of unbelievably expensive and special and amazing wine there. And each person would bring one bottle of wine, and we would, you know, pour it carefully and sip it, and it was great. And then some, you know, often there was wine left in the bottle. And one of the fascinating things was, like, half of you was thinking, oh my God, this is the most amazing wine I've ever had. It would be criminal to waste it. And then half of you was thinking, this is the most amazing wine I've ever had. Like, this is an incredible taste. This is an incredible feeling. I love this wine. I don't need more. More is not more. Sometimes more is less. And one bottle is quite a lot of wine. And you can get more than enough pleasure in many, you know, many cases just from a single glass. So, you know, in a sense, why not get that $100 wine if it really is amazing and special and say, all I need is a few tastes. All I need is a glass. I don't need a whole bottle, let alone five bottles.
Let me take another take on answering Sarah's question. Sarah, we're still thinking about you. And I do like the idea of thinking about the money to happiness sort of map. Mm-hmm. But I like to just lift it up one level and think about, you know, you have a budget, a yearly budget. How much do you spend yearly on wine? And how much do you have left over for other things? Like, if you squeeze the wine budget and had Charles Shaw wine, which is cheaper, would you have more time to go on? Would you have more money to go on trips? You know, it's right. Kind of like...
Yeah, well, let's stick with the Sarah question, which is actually a slightly more interesting one, at least for me, which is, if you have a set wine budget...
How many people have a set wine budget?
But I mean, okay, that's my point. That's my point. We don't have a set wine budget.
No, we don't have a set wine budget. But let's say, ex hypothesize, just for the next 45 seconds. If you have a set wine budget, how do you maximize your pleasure? Do you buy really special wines? Let's assume for the time being that I'm right.
At the very least, let me say it this way. If you have a, let's say you have a set wine budget. Let's go with you. If you buy 20 bottles of $5 wine, would you have 20 dinners with friends? Like, would you be able to include that into a larger sense of well-being and happiness?
And that's a good question. So, you know, and the question is, Carl, I'm going to ask you as the person who's deeply embedded in wine economics, if you had a set wine budget, if you had a $100 wine budget, would you buy $100 wine? Would you buy $25 wines? Would you buy $5 $20 wines? Where would you come down on the sort of quantity versus quality thing? Assume for the time being that you can get better wine by spending more.
I think it just goes back to the question, if we want to decompose, what is wine? And so there is wine, maybe there is such a thing like wine quality, right? So there is a wine and it's wine quality, but you just said also, there's more than that, right? It's just the feeling you have this pricey wine, this wine comes with a story and kind of all of that. So, but the story is not really known to people who I do not know. So if I went to a party and I had to make the choice, I would probably buy a Tubak Chuck and fill it in a Muto Rothschild bottle. That's probably what I would do. And it would be awesome wine. It comes with a wonderful story. It's just perfect. And you can do that many, many, many times. You just need to get the empty bottles.
Okay, now I need to just jump in here and say
that's a brilliant idea.
This is reminding me of a study
that's
I once
economics,
read.
That's economics.
It's reminding me of a study I once read that said economics taught people to lie, that economists.
So I have to mention that last night, in a fit of rosé-fueled enthusiasm.
Wow.
I decided to go to the midnight showing of Magic Mike XXL.
Oh, I want to see that.
Oh, you're wicked, Felix. You're so wicked.
The female gaze.
It was a fantastic movie. It was really overwhelming, I have to say. I would say I maybe sat a little bit too close to the front of the theater. But I will also say this, that in Magic Mike XXL, there is actually an interesting starring role played in a bit part by a bottle of 1959 Chateau Lafite. And
Carl is getting excited.
That's a big year, yeah.
That's a big year. And as Carl knows, that's a big year for Lafite. And there's a bunch of humping and grinding and, you know, abs.
Undulating.
Undulating, yeah. And dancing. But really the only thing in the movie which leads to someone actually having pleasurable sex is this bottle of 1959 Chateau.
Wow, that is a stretch.
But I will say that on the one hand, this is true. Like, I would expect a bottle of 1959 to lead to good sex. I mean, you know, because I think there's a connection between sex and wine. But on the other hand, the context is basically a bunch of, you know, stripper activity. And I don't think of 59 Lafite as a stripper wine. Well, I feel like if you're watching strippers and get, you know, really hooting and hollering, I feel that's a rosé thing rather than the 59 Lafite.
You want
thing.
Like some Moët, like champagne.
Or
like
champagne.
Rosé champagne.
Or rosé champagne. But that was our Magic
so
Mike digression.
So basically, on today's episode, Slate Money listeners, you learned what a date with Felix would be like. This has been highly educational. So, Carl, I want to redirect the conversation somewhere else. What do you think right now is the coolest story in, like, the economics or really in the wine world? What is the, like, what's really cool right now? Just, like, if you had to pick something that everyone should know about that's happening right now.
Oh, everybody should know about that. I think there are two things, and it's always the same thing. It's like, what is the value of wine? What is the story of wine? And to try to decompose these things. So I just talked, before I talked about the California Wine Fair. So we published a paper in 2008, and then again in 2009, it's two papers that are linked, by a guy named Bob Hodgson, or Robert Hodgson. He's a professor of statistics on the West Coast. He's now retired. He has his own winery. He makes wine, and he's the head judge of the California Wine Fair. And that is just a fantastic thing. He called me up in 2006 when he learned, oh, there is this new Journal of Wine Economics. I have this paper. And would that be a thing for you? So he told me that thing on the phone. So as the head judge of the California Wine Fair, which is the largest wine fair in the country, so as I said before, so they taste all of these wines, they give gold medals, silver, bronze. So they wanted to know who of the judges is a good judge and who is a bad judge. So what they did is, not knowing to these wine judges, three wines of the 25 wines they taste are the same, pourings out of the same bottle. And the first idea that they had, a good wine judge will give the same medal to all three of them. So surprise, surprise, there wasn't even 10% of the people that could do that. So they did that in 2005. And then they said, oh, maybe that's a little bit too strict. Let's be more lenient. And like, let's allow a range of two. Like, you give a gold and a bronze to the same wine, you're a good wine judge. It was not even 20% that could do that. Which means 4/5 of the people were all over the place. All over the place. So then they did this in 2006, 2007, up to 2012 when the fair canceled the whole thing. So, and they found always, it was always the same. It's always a tenth of the people were just right. And in the wine world.
Is it the same tenth? Is it the same people from year to year?
It is not. It always changes.
So it's like a random selection.
It always changes because they first thought,
it's like mutual fund managers.
Right. So, and then they quickly got the idea of, or maybe that's just a random choice. Like, if you randomly do this, there's a random chance of being right of 10%. Then he did a second paper where he said he like also makes wine and he submits his wine to wine fairs. And there are like 13 wine fairs and he has all of the data from all of these wine fairs. And so his question was, if I get a gold at the first wine fair, what is my chance to get a second gold at wine fair two? It must be more than random because I got a gold at the first wine fair, which means my wine is very, very good. So I must have a better than random choice to get two golds or three golds or four golds. So, and it's like simple stats, and we love this stuff. It's awesome. It's great for teaching, too. So let's say, and that's pretty much the truth, the chance of getting a gold at any given wine fair is a tenth. So if you run the stats to get a gold at two wine fairs is a tenth times a tenth. So it would be 1%. To get three golds would be
a tenth. If it were totally independent.
Times a tenth times a tenth, right? If that were random. Mm-hmm. If it were totally random. Yeah. So four would be 0.1 to the four and so forth. So he compared like totally random with how it actually is. And it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. So, and he gave this presentation in Napa. This was at our meeting in 2011, I think, or 10. And the press was there and they said, so what does it mean? If you make wine, what do you learn from that? And he said, it's pretty easy. Submit your wine to as many fairs as you can. Yeah. At one of them, you will get a gold. That gold, put on your bottle and say, this wine got a gold medal at the Timbuktu Wine Fair. And maybe you can charge 20 cents more for that.
Okay, so this brings me to our final question from Andrea Ledsinger. And it's the perfect segue. She asks directly to us, are there any wine ratings, point systems, gold medals, or any of those which influence the price of a wine? Like, at what point can... you know, I got this many points or I got this many medals or something like that, allow a winemaker to charge more for their wine?
That seems to be a very easy question, but it's not. It's not easy at all to answer that question. That's an incredibly tricky thing. Let's say there's a wine that's good, right? From a good year and a good firm, and that wine is pricey. And it also got lots of points, let's say from like a wine critic, let's say like Robert Parker, gave this wine like 96 points, which is a lot. So is that wine expensive because of the points or because if it's good or because it's good? So these two things, that is a very tricky thing. You need to disentangle that. And that is statistically an incredibly tricky thing. So because you know that the Parker points depend on quality, right? So this one could be pricey only because of quality, and maybe the Parker points didn't add anything to the price. So there's a lot of econ research on this. What does a price, a medal, and so forth, what does it add to the price?
We need more statistical tests like he was doing with the tasting.
I was about to say, wouldn't there be another level too if the Parker points then cause the sales of that wine to go up and so then retailers can charge more for it? And even if the Parker points are sort of arbitrary because that day he woke up on the right side of the bed and decided this one tasted of grapefruit and whatever
else. Well, maybe. Maybe they do and maybe they don't. And certainly retailers love putting Parker scores and Wine Spectator scores on their shelves because it helps move the wine.
Well, my idea was to have two different bottles, like different labels with the same wine in it and like price one differently or add the points information on one of them, like just kind of statistical tests to see how that changes.
You know what I would do? I'm going to find a wine merchant. If there's any wine merchant out there listening to this who sometimes puts Wine Spectator or Robert Parker scores on the labels under a wine, here's what I want you to do. Don't break the law. Just take that wine and put it in two different parts of your shop. And let's say that it's normally $50. Sell it for $50 in one part of the shop and then sell it for $60, but mention that it has a high Parker rating in the other part of the shop and see how many people buy it for $60 versus how many people buy it for $50.
Could also depend on where in the shop it is, though.
Yeah,
it's tricky.
Too many compounding variables. Well, you switch the locations halfway through the experiment.
Okay, good. I'm with you.
that's one really cool thing. So one paper that I once read, so like from 2005 or 6, and they looked at what is the influence of Parker points on wines from Bordeaux. And that's just a crazy thing, because the wines from Bordeaux you can buy in future. So you there's a future price for these wines, and that's set by the Chateau, like Chateau Lafite, Chateau Mouton Rothschild. They set the price in March, so it was just set. And it's not the market price. It's the price that they set. Normally, before they set the price, Robert Parker goes there, and he tastes these wines. He said, oh, this is really good, and I give 99 points. So then they charge more, or this is not that good, and then they charge less, you would think. So it's just some exercise how to disentangle things. So all the years, all these prices were made based on Parker points. In 2003, Parker had the flu, and he couldn't go. So now Chateau Lafite and Mouton Rothschild and Aubryon, they were kind of, they had to set the price without Parker points. And they set the price according to quality, what they thought is quality. And it's very, very close to Parker points. So from that kind of
because
natural experiment.
Because they've internalized what Robert Parker likes. They know that
could
what
be,
he likes.
That could be, but it's also weather is actually known, right? You know actually quality. And that is, so from that, we actually learned that what Parker adds to the price is like 50 cents a bottle, which is nothing.
So this brings me back to what Carl was saying earlier about the different types of value you get from a wine. And the points when you see points, or the medals when you see medals, generally come from this kind of blind taste. Well, actually, Parker points don't come from blind tastings. Parker point, he knows what he's drinking when he gives rankings. Medals are generally blind. But in any case, all of them come from unbelievably artificial and unrealistic tasting conditions. They're often tasted very early in the morning because people have better taste buds earlier in the morning.
That's what we are doing now, right?
Yeah, except we shouldn't have had our coffee because that's bad. You drink before you have your coffee.
I didn't.
Oh, there you go. And they're drunk often in insane quantities. Professional wine tasters can easily get through 40 or 50 or more red wines in one sitting, at which point your mouth just becomes a sock. You know, it's just, it's horrible. And so you're drinking wine after wine after wine and sipping and slurping and spitting and
pity the wine taster.
No, seriously, it's not a pleasant...
Somebody has to do it.
It's not a pleasant job. Professional wine tasting is actually unpleasant. And if you've ever done it, you will realize this. And not to mention the fact that it just destroys all of your enamel on your teeth. I mean, you need really good dentists.
Do they get insurance? Does the job come with a dental plan?
But in any case, you know, the way that we actually drink wine is never by having 14 different wines in front of us and drinking and slipping and slurping and spitting. It's the most social and convivial drink, and the wines that we remember the most. And if for instance, if you go onto Delectable, which is my favorite app, the way, you know, they ask you to say something about the wine, they'll ask you to rate the wine, but they'll ask you also, very importantly, to say, where are you? Who are you drinking it with? Because that's how you remember wines. It's like, I remember this wine. I was at this place, and I was drinking with this person. And so, you know, the question of how what goes into the enjoyment of a wine is just as much who are you drinking it with, how are you feeling, you know, what's going on in your life. And all of those things, if you have a great bottle of wine and it fits into that context, it's going to be so much better. That's why we enjoy wines when we're on holiday more.
So what you're saying is if you like it, keep drinking it.
And what I'm also saying is that there's a vast range of, to go back to the last question, relationships between quantity and pleasure. That there's certain contexts where drinking lots of wine is better. And I would say that 95% of drinking rosé would fall into that context.
Which is why we have four bottles.
Which is why we
right
have
now.
Four bottles of rosé, and which is why you never see a half-open bottle of rosé in anyone's fridge. Because once you've opened a bottle of rosé, you drink that bottle of rosé. You know, whereas, you know, the more sort of, you know, cerebral sipping wines, you'll be like, ooh, this is a good wine. I don't want the whole bottle. I'll finish it off tomorrow. That kind of thing. You know, that never happens with rosé.
Should we talk about this rosé?
So let's talk about the rosé. We have we all drunk all four of the rosés?
I have.
Yeah. So
yeah, I've not had the Eikendal, the Stellenbosch.
I think I'm going to be the only person who likes that. But that's my guess.
Well, I actually liked it.
Oh, really?
Can I go first because I'm the most naive?
Okay. Kathy, tell us about the four wines and tell us... why don't you, first of all, introduce your own wine and tell us a little bit about
what you brought. I'll tell you the story.
Tell me the story because it's all about story.
Alone. The story is that I went into a local wine shop near my house, which I'd never been in before, and I looked around for pink things. And I found a bunch of pink things that didn't say rosé on them. And I was like, I'm
pink
not
sure. Things?
Pink bottles.
Things.
Pink things. And,
and
so,
there was also someone had a four-year-old daughter in there as well. And she's like, are you a bottle of rosé?
That did not happen. But I was, so dumb question. Like, are all pink wines rosés?
Yes.
Oh, so if it says something like red musk or something, then it's actually a rosé.
Yes.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. So I just kept on slogging to the back of the store until I found something that actually said rosé on it, and I bought it. That's the story of that wine. I also chilled it and brought it here.
How much did you pay for it?
I paid $11.
Okay. Jordan, what did you bring?
So I brought Eichendahl Merlot Petit Verdot Cuvée Rosé from Stellenbosch, South
Cuvée
Africa.
Cuvée means posh.
Yeah. and this is not posh. It was like $11.99. But so I walked around the store looking for something. I knew that Felix was going to bring in something slightly fancier, let's put it that way. And I wanted something to contrast with that. And, you know, I knew absolutely nothing about wine in my life until I spent some time in South Africa. I think I've mentioned that on the show before when I was in college. And I discovered this wonderful thing where there were wine stores that had little taps that you could sample the wine at. And so it took all of the fear and loathing that goes with selecting a bottle blind out of it because you just taste what you liked. And so eventually I found this like one weird Chardonnay I really liked when I was in South Africa that was within my price range. And it tasted, in my head, the descriptor I came up with it was green peppercorns. I don't know if like any professional would ever come up with that.
Probably not.
But that was like what came
and, but also probably all wine descriptors like that are complete bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. So that was what I had in my head.
Was it a little bit green?
Yeah, grassy, a little bit. It was almost like a little like bitterness at the end, but I liked it. Anyway, so that was a wine I came to really like. And for some, now the funny thing is associations. This is a rosé. I have no idea if there's any reason why I should be tasting a similar flavor in this wine, but because it's from the same place, I'm like, oh, I'm sensing that here. It could totally just be the fact that I have that story in my head. So that is the story of this wine.
So that's your wine. My wine is... So we have four wines. My wine is...
you wrote
Domaine,
actually two, right?
I didn't bring any. So there's this wonderful wine called Pinot de Nice. One of my obsessions is the Loire. I love drinking Loire wines. And there are two main grapes in Loire. One is Cabernet Franc for red wine, and the other one is Chenin Blanc for white wine. And the Chenin Blanc has this very weird sort of cousin. The red wine version of Chenin Blanc is Chenin Noir, and it's also called Pinot de Nice. And this is a rosé made from Pinot de Nice by a guy called Jean-Luc Mardon, and it is fantastic. I love it. I bought every single bottle that was available at Viscount Wines and Spirits in Wappingers Falls, New York, last weekend. and I was like, I need to bring this into the... and I bought them up at $9.99 a bottle. And then I said, I need to bring this into Slate Money because it's a fantastic wine. But when I bought it in New York City, it was $16 a bottle. So that gives you a little indication of what the sort of range of prices for any given wine can be. Carl, what did you think of the Domaine Pré-Baron and the other wines? And also, what is the fourth wine that we have?
I didn't bring any. The fourth one is Domaine Haute.
So Domaine Haute. So I wrote this piece about what I called brosé earlier in the week, which is basically why all bros should drink rosé. And... one of the things I said in my piece is if you're drinking Domaine Haute, you're doing it wrong. Because my feeling about rosé is it's a quaffing wine and it really doesn't matter what you're drinking. And the Domaine Haute is $52 a bottle. And why would anyone spend $52 for a bottle of wine? But what did you think of the Domaine Haute?
I think it was pretty nice wine. There's only one wine that I disliked, and that was the Alone. Vino del Mediterraneo. So that
the
I didn't
Spanish
really like.
Wine.
But I really like the wine from Stellenbosch. I totally like the Pinot de Nice. And the Haute was pretty good too. So now we know the prices, or at least we know that the Haute is very expensive. And now it makes you biased. So, but that's the whole story.
Yeah. So my feeling about the wines was basically I liked them all. There was no really bad wine in the bunch. But the one I liked the least was the Domaine Haute. The one I liked the least was the most expensive wine, and I felt it was a bit oily. And I felt like it left this kind of weird texture in my mouth, which I didn't like.
You see, I had like a little floral thing at the end I kind of liked. Or I thought I got flowers out of it. You got like fish oil or something. So this is how subjective all this
is. So what did you have a favorite or least favorite?
Yeah, so I liked the what you brought, the Domaine Prix Baron. I tried it first. The first time I tried it, I thought it was too dry. But then the second time around and then the third and fourth time, it started opening itself up to me. So...
Well, I'm going to sound like I'm just agreeing with you all, but actually I like the Loire Valley one that you brought, Felix, because here's my only test for light wines is does it taste like grapefruit juice? Because I like grapefruit tastes. That one tasted like grapefruit juice to me.
And now that you're saying that, I'm tasting grapefruit.
It's delicious.
As I literally sit
and,
in it,
and,
I have no
and can I
suggestion.
Say that what I was going to do to judge the quality of the wine was not ask you guys what you thought, because honestly, who cares what you think?
Yeah.
The only real judge of the quality of the wine is I'm looking at these four bottles and I'm like, which bottle has the least amount of wine left?
Grapefruit juice.
And the answer is the Loire.
Right, that is correct.
The answer is the Domaine Prix Baron from the Loire, because that is the real test of a wine, is which one do people wind up just picking for themselves and drinking more.
In all fairness, though, it was tied with the Domaine Ott until I just poured myself a glass. So it was neck and neck.
So my lesson from this, you know, is actually not my lesson from this. This is what I wrote earlier in the week in my rosé piece, and it's what I sincerely believe about rosé is, and to answer the question from our listener now, which listener was it? Here we go. It was Andrea Ledsinger. She said, "Can I recommend a good rosé that won't break the bank? Teacher salary, not business or finance. It would make my week." Andrea, yes, I can. Walk into your nearest wine store and pick...
A pink thing.
Whatever it is. It doesn't matter if it's, $9 or $52. It tastes of rosé, and it's going to be awesome in the summer. And you're going to just make sure it's cold and sit out in the sun or in the shade and enjoy it, and you will have loads of pleasure. And this is... Of all wines, rosé does not lend itself to snobbishness. Would you agree, Carl?
Yeah, I totally would agree. I would like to change the whole thing. I would like to come up with a whole new topic.
This is already a long podcast, Carl. What is your whole new topic?
Yeah,
Carl?
I just want to keep going. Yeah,
it's called Slate Money, so what is the real rate of return to holding wine? Isn't that a big thing?
Ah, yes.
You have wine in lieu of stock?
There are funds you can invest.
There are funds in, and there's this whole thing which people used to believe, and I don't know if people still believe, that wine gets better with age. And some wine does, but a minority of wine. Oh, and by the way, this is also, Andrea, if you want a very good rule of thumb for picking rosé, pick the 2014. If it says 2013 or earlier on it, that's a really bad idea.
Right.
Just white wine, nearly all white wine and all rosé wine, with the possible exception of, you know, a Lopez Derrida from Spain, which is a whole other thing, should never be drunk aged.
Carl, do you know about the Panoply Network of Slate podcasts? I feel like you don't only have a journal in you about wine, but you might have a
whole
podcast.
Yeah, you might have a whole show.
I feel like, yeah.
I don't know about this.
I feel like this shouldn't just be an episode of Slate Money. This should be an entire podcast just devoted to wine. Thank you all for listening to Slate Money. Go out, please. We're early in the summer. You have all of July, all of August, and a good chunk of September to be drinking large quantities of rosé. Oh, and this is the other thing you can do, which I can highly, highly recommend if you care about price and quality and all of that kind of stuff. It's quite easy to find $25 3-liter boxes of rosé.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah, and box wine is a variable quality, but box rosé is normally just like all rosé, perfectly
good.
I have not had a keg.
You can get cans now. Cans of rosé.
I would highly recommend not getting the cans. I would highly recommend getting the box. Put the box in the fridge. When you need some rosé, just go to the fridge and pour yourself a glass.
This is the man who is arguing for the story of wine. No, 20 minutes ago.
It's 25 for 3 liters. 3 liters is 4 bottles, so that works out really cheap on a per bottle basis. The wine is exactly the same that you would normally pay like 10 or 12 bucks a bottle for. You're not paying for the glass. You're not paying for the cork. And wine lasts weeks in the box because it doesn't oxidize. So it's a fantastic way to just get through large quantities of rosé. And frankly, if you're not going through large quantities of rosé, you are doing it wrong.
And on that note, drive safely, my friends.
And if you want a story for your box, just play this episode over and over.
Play this episode while you're drinking your rosé. Thank you all for listening. Cheers to all of you. Do subscribe to Slate Money. It's not always about wine, but we're normally, you know, just as happy. Let us know if we are slurring at this point by writing to us at slatemoney@slate.com. And leave a special thank you to Audrey Quinn, who produced Slate Money this week and who did a sterling job because God knows we were completely
sloshed. And let me add, she sat through this sober.
Somehow she didn't come in here and help herself to the Domaine Pré-Baron, but she will be able to help herself in a minute or two. So yes, listen to the Panoply Network. All of them are at itunes.com/panoply, not yet including the forthcoming Carl Wine podcast, but we're going to work on that. We will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.